not enough testing is being done in the first place. Of those confirmed cases, 20% were serious or critical. More than 150 people in Gaza have died from the coronavirus so far. From the beginning, there were well-founded fears that the pandemic would do disproportionate harm in Gaza. With community transmission now seemingly out of control, those fears may soon become reality. The unlivable Gaza Strip is home to some 2 million people, more than 40% of them aged 14 years old or younger, two-thirds of them refugees, confined to its 139 square miles. It is one of the most densely populated places in the world. It has also one of the highest unemployment rates on the planet, and more than half of its residents live in poverty. Like every other sector in Gaza, the healthcare system has deteriorated after more than 13 years of siege and repeated brutal Israeli regime military offensives. Gaza's medical centers were still reeling from an epidemic of catastrophic injuries caused by the Israeli regime's use of live fire against civilian protesters when the pandemic hit. Shortages of essential medical supplies, to say nothing of electricity and fuel to operate generators during power outages, are nothing new in Gaza. At the end of November, the health ministry in the territory reported that it had less than a one-month supply of nearly half of all essential medicines. It also had critical shortages of medical disposables. For years, Gaza's medical system has been on the brink of collapse due to the Zionist regime's brutal siege. This is part of the permanent emergency borne by Israeli regime's occupation, colonization, and apartheid, as the human rights group Al-Haq states in a new position paper on COVID-19 and Palestinians' right to health. COVID-19 poses a disproportionate and substantial threat to a Palestinian society deliberately denied for decades the right to develop a functioning healthcare system, according to Al-Haq. This is a direct result of apartheid policies and practices imposed by Israeli regime's prolonged occupation, the Palestinian group adds. Gaza, under a severe economic blockade and exacerbated Israeli regime's closure since 2007, has been cut off from the West Bank, which has been divided up into enclaves with differing degrees of limited Palestinian self-rule. This fragmentation is a key strategy of the Zionist regime's apartheid, a 2017 study by the UN Economic and Social Commission found. Israeli regime's prolonged occupation, colonization, and apartheid have deprived the Palestinians of their means of subsistence, according to Al-Haq. Humanitarian aid, like the COVID testing kits provided by WHO, addresses gaps in basic services. But it does not remedy the persistent and pervasive violation of Palestinians' basic rights. Beyond Israeli regime's movement restrictions, the ongoing denial of Palestinian self-determination remains a major impediment to the full and progressive realization of Palestinians' economic, social, and cultural rights, including to health, Al-Haq states. Palestinians are denied access to clean water and adequate sanitation, while political prisoners held by the Israeli regime face overcrowded and unsanitary detention conditions, the rights group adds. The political and historic forces to which Palestinians have been subjected compound their susceptibility to COVID-19, according to Al-Haq. The Zionist regime, as the occupying power, is legally, not just morally, obliged to provide essential supplies to the civilians living under its rule. Like so many of its obligations, the Zionist regime flouts its legal duties as third states look on and do almost nothing. As COVID-19 compounds Palestinian oppression, international justice and accountability are needed now more than ever to bring an end to the Israeli regime impunity, Al-Haq states. The group is calling for a full, thorough, and comprehensive investigation by the International Criminal Court and for the implementation of recommendations of prior UN inquiries into the Israeli regime's violations of Palestinian rights. Meanwhile, the heads of the European Union's diplomatic missions in Ramallah and Al-Quds visited Gaza for the first time since 2016. This remarkably long absence belies their claim that Gaza remains a priority for the EU and its member states. Though it acknowledges the dire humanitarian crisis in Gaza, the EU's statement on the visit barely mentions the Israeli regime's responsibility for the situation and makes no mention at all of its obligations as the occupying power. Instead, EU representatives Steve Kahn, Van Berstroff issued a generic call that all duty bearers should act now and respect their obligations under international law. The EU boasts of its humanitarian funding for Gaza's suffering population, but it is precisely because of the EU's stubborn unwillingness to hold the Zionist regime directly accountable that the Palestinian doctors who briefed its diplomats face such unprecedented challenges.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome once again to another program of For a Better Life. We were talking about arrogance, dear brothers and sisters, and we also talked about the reasons why we get arrogance, why this feeling come within us. And number one, it was property and wealth that could give us arrogance if we don't work on ourselves to be humble. And number two, it could be knowledge, especially for those who are students, that knowledge could give us arrogance. I know something that you do not know. And number three, fame, celebrity, family connections. My father is this and that person. My brother is this and that person, and so on and so forth. All of these things could give us arrogance. And we also talked about the cure. One of the cures was, one of the remedies was to be humble. If you're humble and you practice some techniques, that might crush your ego, that might crush your feeling of arrogance. And it does not matter if you are the CEO of a billion-dollar corporation, if you are a manager of a bank, if you are a manager of a hospital. If you do these techniques, which brings humbleness, which crushes your arrogance, try to be humble. Another thing one can do is not to give orders. Because when one gives an order, it means usually that he or she thinks he is bigger than others. He is more important than others. You know, Ayatollah Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, his wife would say later on that Ayatollah Khomeini never gave us any orders. He would never give us any order. Bring me a glass of water. Bring me my shirt. Bring me my shoes. Do this and that. But he would say, It feels like the weather is cold today. It feels very chilly in the room. And by doing so, by saying it indirectly, we understood that maybe he wants a shirt, and we would go up and bring a shirt for him. You see, the respect and the adab, the ethics that Ayatollah Khomeini has when it comes to his own family. And there is nothing wrong, according to the Sharia, to give orders within your family. But again, you see that you have to see yourself as the most humble person. Or if you want anything, you could say please, thank you. Practice those words. Even if you give an order, you can say please, ask for it in a nice manner. That will again stop your arrogance from growing. But the most ideal form, dear brothers and sisters, is that you do not give any orders at all and try to do it yourself. And for any reason, if you cannot, or it's more practical if that person in your family does it for you, you could ask very kindly, practice to talk very nicely to that person and ask for that thing that you need. Some trustworthy people relate that the late Mirza Muhammad Taqi Shirazi, one of the scholars of the deen, would even refrain from giving orders not only to his followers, not only to people in the society, but even refrain from giving orders in his house. He would not order his wife to bring dinner or clear the dishes. He would go without dinner if his family forgot to give it to him. And that again is nothing wrong. It is not forbidden if you give orders in your family. But one must practice fighting against his nafs, fighting against this carnal soul, if he wants to be a man. If he wants to be a true human being, if he wants to reach the lofty values of a true human being, you have to practice over and over again.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
If a CEO of a huge corporation does not practice before that corporation becomes a billion-dollar corporation, before that the corporation becomes a million-dollar corporation, if that person X, the CEO, does not practice on himself to be humble towards the staff members, being humble towards people outside in the society, towards his taxi driver, towards the people who receive him, the people in the hotel, the people who serve him in the VIP section in the airplane, the people who serve him everywhere, if he does not practice early on in his career to be humble, that will be very, very hard for him to practice those techniques when he becomes the CEO of a huge corporation later on. So we have to practice right now. Right now is the moment to practice and being humble towards anyone, towards the sweeper who sweeps the street, your alley. When you pass him, you send your salam to him, you send your peace greeting to him. Ask how he is. When you see the doorkeeper, send your salam to him. Anyone that is not usually seen as an important person, even the children, send your salam to them first. Greet them first before they greet you. Crush your ego, crush your arrogance as much as possible, and see it as daily practices. Daily practice, every single day when you see a child, you send your salam first. And I can even go further than that. But you can practice these techniques if you want to rectify your values, if you want to demolish this feeling of arrogance which is growing within us. It could be working hand in hand or side by side with a nurse with unclean things. These things would help you. It could be to drive and give plastic bags of food to people. Crush your arrogance as much as possible, and you will see that other doors will open up for you, opportunities will open up for you, a light will shine within you. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala help us all in practicing these tools, these techniques. Until next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. Your love is all I need. All I need. It's all I need. Love is all I need. All I need. Love is all I need. Oh,
your love is all I need. To be all I need. And I know that you see how much you mean to me. You mean to me, 'cause your love is all I need, to be all I can be, and I know that you see how much you mean to me.
Your love is all I need.
In the limelight.
At noon on 20th of January, presuming he doesn't have to be dragged out of the White House as a trespasser, Donald Trump will make one last walk across the South Lawn, take his seat inside Marine One, and be gone. From that moment, Trump's rambunctious term as President of the United States will be over. But in one important aspect, the challenge presented by his presidency will have only just begun. The possibility that he will face prosecution for crimes committed before he took office or whilst in the Oval Office. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Ed Pilkington. The piece is titled, How Real is the Threat of Prosecution for Donald Trump Post-Presidency? Stay with us for more of Ed Pilkington's article. Noon on 20th of January, presuming he doesn't have to be dragged out of the White House as a trespasser, Donald Trump will make one last walk across the South Lawn, take his seat inside Marine One and be gone. From that moment, Trump's rambunctious term as President of the United States will be over, but in one important aspect, the challenge presented by his presidency will have only just begun. The possibility that he will face prosecution for crimes committed before he took office or whilst in the Oval Office. "You've never had a president before who has invited so much scrutiny," said Bob Bauer, the White House counsel under Barack Obama. "This has been a very eventful presidency that raises hard questions about what happens when Trump leaves office." For the past 4 years, Trump has been shielded from legal jeopardy by a Justice Department memo that rules out criminal prosecution of a sitting president. But the second he boards that presidential helicopter and fades into the horizon, all bets are off. The Manhattan District Attorney, Cyrus Vance, is actively investigating Trump's business dealings. The focus described in court documents is extensive and protracted criminal conduct at the Trump Organization, including possible bank fraud. A second major investigation by the fearsome federal prosecutors of the Southern District of New York has already led to the conviction of Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen. Cohen pleaded guilty to campaign finance violations relating to the hush money paid to Stormy Daniels, who alleged an affair with Trump during the 2016 presidential campaign. During the course of the prosecution, Michael Cohen implicated a certain individual one, thought to be Donald Trump, as the mastermind behind the felony. Though the investigation was technically closed last year, charges could be revisited once Donald Trump's effective immunity is lifted. It all points to a momentous and fiendishly difficult legal challenge fraught with political danger for the incoming Biden administration. Should Donald Trump be investigated and possibly prosecuted for crimes committed before and during his presidency? It looks like the incoming administration will have to confront some form of these issues, said Bob Bauer, who is co-author of After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. The government is going to have decisions to make about how to respond, given the potential that it becomes a source of division. Any attempt to hold Trump criminally liable in a federal prosecution would be a first in U.S. history. No exiting president has ever been pursued in such a way by his successor. Richard Nixon was spared the ordeal by Gerald Ford's contentious presidential pardon. Previous presidents have tended to take the view that it is better to look forward in the name of national healing than backwards at the failings of their predecessor. And for good reasons. Any prosecution would probably be long and difficult, act as a huge distraction, and expose the incoming president to accusations that they were acting like a tin pot dictator hounding their political enemy. That a possible Trump prosecution is being discussed at all is a sign of the exceptional nature of the past 4 years. Those who argue in favor of legal action accept that there are powerful objections to going after Trump, but urge people to think about the alternative, the dangers of inaction. If you do nothing, you are saying that though the President of the United States is not above the law, in fact he is. And that would set a terrible precedent for the country and send a message to any future president that there is no effective check on their power, said Andrew Weissman, who was a lead prosecutor in Robert Mueller investigation looking into coordination between Russia and Trump's 2016 campaign. As head of one of the three main teams answering to the special counsel Robert Mueller, Andrew Weissman had a ringside seat on what he calls Trump's lawless White House. In his new book, Where Law Ends, He argues that the prevailing view of the 45th president is that following the rules is optional and that breaking them comes at minimal, if not zero, cost. Andrew Weissman told The Guardian that there would be a price to be paid if that attitude went unchallenged once Donald Trump leaves office. One of the things we learned from this presidency was that our system of checks and balances is not as strong as we thought, and that would be exacerbated by not holding him to account. Bob Bauer, White House counsel under Barack Obama and an advisor to Joe Biden during the presidential campaign, who has no role in the transition team, is also worried that a sort of double immunity would be established. Presidents cannot be prosecuted whilst in office under Justice Department rules. But under such a double immunity, nor could they be prosecuted once they leave the White House in the interests of national healing. And so the president is immune coming and going, and I think that would be very difficult to square with the idea that he or she is not above the law. Joe Biden has made clear his lack of enthusiasm for prosecuting Donald Trump, saying it would be probably not very good for democracy. But he has also made clear that he would leave that decision to his appointed attorney general, following the norm of Justice Department independence that Donald Trump has repeatedly shattered. Other prominent Democrats have taken a more bullish position, adding pressure on the incoming Attorney General to be aggressive. During the Democratic primary debates, Elizabeth Warren called for an independent task force to be set up to investigate any Trump corruption or other criminal acts whilst Donald Trump was in office. Kamala Harris also took a stance that may come to haunt the new administration. The vice president-elect, asked by NPR last year whether she would want to see charges brought by the Department of Justice, replied, "I believe that they would have no choice and that they should, yes." There are several possible ways in which the Justice Department could be forced to confront the issue of whether or not to take on Donald Trump. One would be through a revelation, as yet unknown, following the emergence of new information. Andrew Weissman points out that the Biden administration will have access to a wealth of documents that were previously withheld from Congress during the impeachment inquiry, including intelligence agency and State Department files. Official communications sent by Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump through their personal emails and messaging apps, an ironic move given the flack Hillary Clinton endured from the Trump family in 2016 for using her personal email server, may also become available for scrutiny. But the two most likely avenues for the pursuit of any criminal investigation would relate to Donald Trump's use of his presidential pardon power and alleged obstruction of justice. Trump issued a series of pardons largely characterized by political self-interest, Andrew Weissman said. Though the presidential pardon power is extensive, it is not, as Donald Trump has claimed, absolute, including the absolute right to pardon himself. He's not immune from bribery charges if he were found to have offered somebody a pardon in exchange for their silence in a judicial case. For Andrew Weissman, the way Trump continually teased his associates, including Roger Stone and Paul Manafort, with a promise of pardons in the middle of a federal prosecution was especially egregious. There may be a legitimate reason to give somebody a pardon, but what's the legitimate reason for dangling a pardon other than to thwart that person from cooperating with the government? Perhaps the most solid evidence of criminal wrongdoing compiled against Donald Trump concerns obstruction of justice. John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor, went so far as to say that for Donald Trump, obstruction of justice to further his own political interests was a way of life. In his final report on the Russia investigation, Robert Mueller laid out 10 examples of Trump's behavior that could be legally construed as obstruction of justice. Though Mueller declined to say whether they met the standard for charges, the U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr suggested they did not, but gave no explanation for his thinking. He did leave them in plain sight for any future federal prosecutor to revisit. In one of the starkest of those incidents, Donald Trump tried to scupper the special counsel inquiry itself by ordering his White House counsel, Don McGahn, to fire Robert Mueller. When that became public, he compounded the abuse by ordering Don McGahn to deny the truth in an attempt to cover up. Andrew Weissman, who played a key role in gathering the evidence against Donald Trump in the Robert Mueller investigation, said that such obstruction thus goes to the very heart of why Donald Trump should face prosecution. When the president, no matter who it is, obstructs a special counsel investigation, there have to be consequences. If you can obstruct an investigation criminally, but you don't have to worry about ever being prosecuted, well then, there is no point in ever appointing a special counsel.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, the motives of slander. Brothers and sisters, we all know that slandering is bad. Slandering is one of those sins that may not be forgiven unless the repentance is sought in a proper manner. Now, the question is, what are the motivations and motives of somebody who slanders others? Well, there are several motives for slander. The first one is, and these are, you know, just a list of slanders for you to get going and thinking. You know, these are not all of the motives, but it'll get you thinking and you will start to feel empowered. The first one is malice and revenge. As there is no easier and simpler way than slander and damaging a person's reputation and character for extinguishing flames of spite and revenge blazing in the heart of some people. Number two is envy. as the envious person always wishes for end of blessings of the envied one. When he cannot achieve his purpose, for compensating it, he tries to damage the envied person's reputation and credit through slander, and revealing his weak points and reveals the deficiencies this person has. In addition, this whole action, this whole policy of slandering other, what does it do to this person, the slanderer? It relieves the fire of his envy in this manner. Number three, acquitting oneself from a committed sin. In other words, one tries to simplify or justify his actions through mentioning the faults of others. So this is, these are the few of these motives, and we're going to go over a few more after a short break. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the motives for slander. What is it that drives people to become slanderer? We went over 3 points before the break. Let's talk about the fourth one. Mockery and deride. Of course, mockery and deriding others have several motives, and after rooting of its factors in man's entity, one of the ways of realization of this goal is slander. Number five. Recreation and amusement. There are a lot of people who engage in mentioning weak points and faults of others only for recreation and amusement, or warming circles and meetings, because no other sin is sweeter than slander for people. It should also be noted that people not only enjoy recreation and amusement, but also enjoy causing others to laugh. Number six. Exciting of curiosity instinct. This instinct, which is one of the most powerful man's instincts, invites man to urge others for slander and revealing weak points of different individuals. And perhaps the sweetness of slander for some people originates from the false satiation of this instinct. Of course, taking into account these factors can be effective help to us for treatment of slander and identifying its senses. So yeah, these are some of those motives for slander, but like we said, the list is exhaustive. These are some of those motives that are most commonly found by the psychologists, and this is going to help you start thinking. Now, why are we discussing this? One of the reasons we are discussing it is so we can identify whether this disease, whether this evil exists within our soul or not. Because like we said, slandering others is a spiritual disease. So this is a time for me and you to inshallah go back and introspect, reflect on whether we have and possess this disease or not. If we do, God forbid, now is the time to repent and give up this bad habit. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
First came the warning, then came the blast, shattering the Christmas morning silence in the heart of Nashville, Tennessee's tourist district. Before dawn on Friday, 25th of December, Nashville police officers rushed to calls of gunfire on 2nd Avenue. A strip of honky-tonks, restaurants, and boot shops. Instead of gunfire, they found an RV blaring a strange and unsettling message. There was a bomb. It would detonate in 15 minutes. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jamie McKee, Rick Rojas, Lucy Tompkins, and Derek Bryson Taylor. The piece is titled, A Warning, Then a Blast. Nashville Explosion Was Deliberate, Police Say. First came the warning, then came the blast, shattering the Christmas morning silence in the heart of Nashville, Tennessee's tourist district. Before dawn on Friday, Nashville police officers rushed to calls of gunfire on 2nd Avenue, a strip of honky-tonks, restaurants, and boot shops. Instead of gunfire, they found an RV, blaring a strange and unsettling message. There was a bomb. It would detonate in 15 minutes. When the RV did explode, it sent plumes of smoke billowing above the city, blew out windows in shops and offices for several blocks, left three people hospitalized, and the city of Nashville shaken. Police said the explosion was deliberate. It was also deeply unsettling, coming in an area that draws thousands of people nightly. But who set it off and why remained unknown, as officials began to make sense of the blast. The whole neighborhood shook, said Lily Hansen, who was sitting on her couch in her second-floor apartment in a loft building a few blocks away. She looked outside. I just can't get the image out of my head. The police released a photograph of the RV on Friday afternoon and said the vehicle had arrived on 2nd Avenue North at 1:22 a.m. local time. The RV was parked outside an AT&T transmission building, a separate building from the landmark 33-story AT&T office tower less than half a mile away. It is still unclear if a person was inside the RV when it exploded, officials said. In a news conference on Friday evening, police officials said there were no indications of fatalities, but possible human tissue had been found amid the debris. Gas lines were shut off in the area and AT&T experienced outages, which forced the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, to temporarily halt flights out of Nashville International Airport. Nashville's mayor, John Cooper, said he saw extensive damage when he surveyed the area, including shattered windows and glass that had showered onto sidewalks, charred trees and water main breaks. At least 41 businesses have been materially damaged by the explosion, he said. Fire officials added that one building across from the explosion collapsed. Still, he acknowledged a measure of relief. Had the explosion taken place on a working day, he said, the outcome could have been far more dangerous. But he added later in the day that solace had shifted to resolving to find the perpetrators of this act and to rebuilding the area. This morning's attack on our community was intended to create chaos and fear in this season of peace and hope, Nashville Mayor John Cooper said. The FBI field office in Memphis, Tennessee, was taking the lead in the investigation, working with state and local enforcement agencies, as well as Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives. Acting Attorney General Jeff Rosen was briefed on the incident early this morning and directed all the Department of Justice resources be made available to assist in the investigation. A Justice Department spokesman said in a statement. Acting Attorney General Jeff Rosen became the Acting Attorney General on Wednesday after William Barr stepped down. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee said in a statement on Twitter that the state would supply any needed resources to determine what had happened and who was responsible. Bill Lee said he was praying for those who were injured and was thankful to the emergency workers. A spokesman for President Donald Trump said the president had been briefed on the explosion and was grateful for the incredible first responders and praying for those who were injured. The authorities said the explosion happened around 6:30 a.m. local time outside of 166 2nd Avenue North in a stretch of downtown with cafes, restaurants, barbecues, and bus stores. It is an area where the tourists who come to Nashville, Tennessee often flock to. But on Christmas morning, it was quiet. It's not a very populated area, Mr. Cooper said. After police officers arrived, they hurried to roust anyone they could find. The guests staying in nearby hotels, residents just waking up in the apartment buildings, people who had curled into the warmest crevices they could find as they slept on the street. A voice announced through a loudspeaker on the RV that a bomb would detonate and then began a countdown interspersed with music, the police said. A bomb squad was on its way, but it was too late. The RV exploded exactly as the recording had warned. Don Aaron, a spokesman for the Metropolitan Nashville Police Department, said the police officers' quick work in evacuating the area helped prevent the explosion from causing more harm. We think lives were saved by those officers doing just that, he said. On 2nd Avenue, just a block away from the Cumberland River, the blast left the roadway blackened with debris, including scorched trees and the hulls of vehicles destroyed by the explosion. Fire trucks and emergency vehicles were gathered at the edge of downtown and blue lights flashed under the Hard Rock Cafe's large spinning guitar on Broadway. Except for a distant fire alarm and the sounds of a helicopter, downtown Nashville was quiet on Friday afternoon. The RV exploded just outside the Melting Pot, a fondue restaurant in downtown building, like many others in the area, that was erected in the late 19th century. Windows on either end of the building were blown out, as were the large, heavy doors at the building's entrance. The explosion also triggered the sprinkler system, which flooded the restaurants for about 8 hours. It's a mess, said Mark Rosenthal, one of the restaurant's owners. We have about 115 people working there, but that's 115 people that now don't have jobs, so that's rough to think about.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Right.
roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Round the world with reporters.
The Palestinian Refugees Committee in the Gaza Strip organized a rally against the UN AIDS and Health Services reduction. Palestinian refugees who have impacted badly by this reduction participated in the demonstration, calling for the world body's attention to the dire condition in the impoverished enclave.
It's our right to get the UN's aid services. People here are living in a deteriorating condition amid the pandemic. People here can't afford living, and now, with the reduction of the UN aid services, their life is getting even worse.
Palestinians believe the reduction in aid services by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, is an attempt by the U.S. to liquidate the humanitarian organization. Earlier, the U.S. announced plans to withhold $65 million of aid to the UNRWA until further notice.
The UN aid services reduction will have dire consequences as it deprives the Palestinian refugees from their basic rights. The reduction comes amid a critical political time as Israel is stepping up its pressure on the Palestinians.
By reducing the refugees' aid, the UN is standing beside the Israeli occupation at the expense of Palestinians' rights. We are calling for our rights, and the UN should fulfill its commitments.
The demonstrators call on the international community to reverse the reduction decision by the UN and keep on supporting the Palestinian refugees who have lost their lands and were expelled since 1948.
The reduction policy aims at reducing the aid services step by step until Palestinians are completely deprived of their rights. The UNRWA was established to help and support Palestinian refugees. The reduction policies serve Israel's interests.
UNRWA was established to aid the 700,000 Palestinians who were expelled from their homes during the war surrounding Israeli occupation's establishment in 1948.
More than the half of the 2 million people in the Gaza Strip are dependent on support from UNRWA, and depriving them from the services they need will worsen the living conditions. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Some 12 million children are facing a nightmare in Yemen, where one child dies every 10 minutes from preventable disease and the lack of healthcare services due to the ongoing war and the blockade imposed by the Saudi coalition.
We are about to enter the seventh year since the start of the aggression against our country, which has greatly affected the humanitarian situation, especially for children, who are the most affected segment in all aspects of life, such as health, education, social, and other aspects. And they have lost all the rights guaranteed by international human rights law.
The numbers of affected children continue to grow each day. 2.1 million children are acutely malnourished and 358,000 severely malnourished, meaning that some children are already suffering under famine-like conditions. Meanwhile, Yemen's Ministry of Health held a press conference to shed more light on the dire conditions of children in the country.
What the children of Yemen suffer as a result of the Saudi aggression and blockade since March 2015 is a real humanitarian catastrophe by all international standards. More than 2,400,000 children are deprived of education, and more than 3 million children are homeless. Malnutrition, which is spreading among children, has been condemned by international organizations and is said to be the result of not getting enough food.
Saudi Arabia has committed countless atrocities against the children in Yemen, where children are also targeted by airstrikes. The air attacks have killed thousands of children and left thousands more suffering from disabilities, not to mention travel restrictions on thousands of patients, including children who need to travel for treatment.
As the world is silently watching an entire people being deprived of the basics of life, Yemen has become the most dangerous place in the world for children to grow up, according to UNICEF. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
The Knesset, the Israeli parliament, dissolved itself and the unity cabinet collapsed, pushing the Israelis into yet another early election on 23rd of March that would be the fourth in 2 years. The Knesset dispersed after failing to meet the legal deadline for approving a budget for 2020. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of the conservative Likud party had refused to present a budget in violation of his coalition agreement with his main rival turned partner Benny Gantz of the centrist Blue and White party.
The dissolving of the Knesset was simply because of Netanyahu's unwillingness to give up the premiership. The very possible scenario is the return of another political impasse for Israel. So Netanyahu will not be able to form a coalition that's satisfying and acceptable for all parties. We may even witness a fifth election after the upcoming vote.
Experts, however, say the dissolving of the Knesset would have been more advantageous for Netanyahu. It's not only a deep distrust between Netanyahu and Gantz. Netanyahu was gambling on another election in the hope of forming a right-wing religious cabinet that would grant him some kind of immunity from prosecution. Netanyahu's corruption trial is scheduled to move into an intensive evidentiary stage in early 2021, requiring his regular presence in court. The current cabinet will remain in place in a caretaker capacity until after the election, and the formation of a new cabinet is a process that could take many months. However, the Israelis are convinced that there isn't any guarantee that the fourth election would finally end Israel's internal dogged stalemate.
According to observers, Netanyahu has triggered early elections in an attempt to stay in power beyond his current term. However, they add that Netanyahu's fight for re-election is a difficult battle, mainly as his corruption trial is scheduled to resume with witness testimony next February. Mona Kandib, Occupy, Ramallah.
Every year ahead of Christmas, this street in downtown Tehran gets packed with Christian residents in the capital, a rush to buy last-minute items to celebrate the birth of Jesus. This year, however, the hustle and bustle is gone, as the coronavirus pandemic has emptied the streets and pushed people into their homes. Many families cannot celebrate the festive season together. But Christians here say this does not mean they should abandon the celebrations when they can do it online.
Happy New Year and Merry Christmas to all. This year we miss all the family gatherings, but it's all right. We can catch up with each other using video calls. I hope that in the new year, the pandemic will be gone.
Merry Christmas to all Iran and all the world. And in spite of that we have this pandemic time, I wish everybody will have very soon good times, and 2021 will be happy for every of us.
Nearly 120,000 Christians live in Iran. The majority of them are Armenians, who follow the Oriental Orthodox branch of Christianity. While they make up less than 1% of the Iranian population, they feel at home when it comes to Christmas.
Merry Christmas. It's good to see the Christmas atmosphere running deep here in Iran, where the majority are Muslims. We feel at home here.
Iran has for the past month been under nationwide lockdown to contain the resurging virus. This has curtailed religious ceremonies across the red zones in the country, and church rituals are no exception.
While 2020 was not a happy year, Christians here say it taught humanity a great lesson, to value even the shortest moments with their loved ones. Knowing this year's Christmas, Happy New Year is more than just a wish, and everyone is praying that in 2021, the coronavirus will be a thing of the past. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Karina was a working mom with a job in the tourism sector, decimated by the pandemic. With no savings to fall back on,